This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. A new report by the Annie E. Casey Foundation examines how mass incarceration impacts the whole family of an inmate. According to researchers, there are 5 million children in the U.S. who've had a parent incarcerated at some point in their lives. Given how the prison system of both states and the federal government is inadequate in so many ways, it's no surprise that few resources, if any, exist to support the families of inmates. The report is called A Shared Sentence: The Devastating Toll of Parental Incarceration on Kids, Families, and Communities. My guest is Scott Spencer. He is the Associate Director for Influence and Advocacy at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thanks very much, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So now, according to your report, from 1980 to 2000, the number of kids without a father in prison or jail rose by 500%. This, of course, shouldn't surprise us if we know that our rate of incarceration during those years, 1980 to 2000, rose dramatically. It follows that if we're imprisoning more people, we're impacting more families and subsequently more kids, right?
That's true. I mean, as you mentioned in the opening, it's about 5 million kids that have been impacted by the lack of presence of a parent or guardian in their lives. So it's a pretty significant impact. And what's even more striking is the fact that, you know, as we know, with the number of folks who were incarcerated being around 1.2 million, the vast majority of those are African-American men. And so therefore, we have a large number of African-American children in communities that are also impacted by this.
Right. So we know that our prison system, our incarceration and our criminal justice system disproportionately impacts people of color, as you mentioned, in particular, the nation's Black community. Now, what about the fact that the children that are left behind and the families that are left behind also live within communities that are by themselves less able to support these families than whiter, wealthier neighborhoods and communities?
That's true. I mean, they're largely coming from the incarcerated are largely coming from poorer communities, and therefore the impact of the vacuum of these folks missing from the communities means that there is also this vacuum of their income that's missing from the communities, which only exacerbates the challenge for the families that are left behind and also the entire neighborhoods that are left behind. One of the things that we actually highlight and have uncovered in the report is that, out of these households, about 65% of them report that they cannot meet their basic needs because of the lack of income in their households. Mm. And by that, by basic needs, we mean the ability to make payments on things like, making choices on making payments, things like rent, utilities, food, healthcare, those things that everybody needs every day to make it through their day, through their week, through their month, just to be able to survive. So it's a pretty large and devastating impact from an economic standpoint as well.
So the economics are really crucial here, because when we think about our incarceration system, those who are proponents of tough on crime basically feel that if you have committed a crime, you ought to pay the price. You ought to deal with the punishment. However, your family hasn't committed a crime, but the family pays the price because all of a sudden they've lost a breadwinner. Is it fair to say that we just don't have systems in place to replace the income that a family loses when a loved one is imprisoned?
Well, let me first start out with what's missing in the household. I mean, you know, yes, you're right in the fact that the person is missing. And I think what we sort of lose in this conversation is the fact that there is a family that is left behind. You know, the discussion around incarceration and reform is really around the person, but where we have where we haven't really touched the mark has been the fact that all these folks are parents, brothers, mothers, fathers, related to somebody who's being left behind. So the first thing we wanted to do in sort of bringing this report out was really to highlight the fact that we wanted to focus on the fact that there are people who are left behind first. And now let's talk about how we address the supports and needs. And in that area, there are actually things that are available through existing resources. While there may be some other resources that may be required, there are actually things that we can actually do right now within the existing regulations and systems to provide some supports.
So let's talk about what happens when children grow up without one or more parent, and when that parent is imprisoned. What is the emotional impact, particularly when your father is in prison? Because the majority, I understand, of children who have parents incarcerated are missing a father who might be in prison, right?
Yes, they are. And I mean, there are the range of impacts for a kid in general. I mean, the trauma that a child experiences, you know, studies have found that the effects are like those of abuse or divorce or domestic violence. So those are some severe and long-term traumatic impacts.
You're saying they're comparable to the same kinds of traumas you have when children have parents who divorce or there's domestic violence?
Correct, correct. But you were asking the question specifically about, it was about when the father is missing or when the male is missing in the household. And you know, the male missing in the household, you know, well, I'd say either parent, but particularly with the male, the sort of the impact that it has, first of all, in the household, in whatever that father figure may be, but also how it may look in the community. You know, we started looking at this work particularly because of what we saw as sort of the vacuum of missing men in neighborhoods. And how one may look at that is that there is that sense of security that may be missing in the household. There is, in you know, this being the United States, the male is generally the larger breadwinner. So there is that economic impact that also plays out in the family. But you know, from any kid's standpoint, not having either parent around, the parent who would give you that guidance and advice, the parent that would, you know, give you that sense of reassurance that everything is going to be okay, is a pretty pretty significant gap in a kid's life.
What about mothers? How many children have lost their mothers into the prison system? And I can imagine that the emotional trauma of young kids in particular growing up without a mother are quite significant.
You know, I don't know the numbers specifically about mothers, but and there are fewer mothers, but it's a fairly good percentage of mothers that are also missing. And, you know, the maternal bond, you know, for all of us who have one, is one that is can be lifelong and life impacting, and to be able to miss the bond with your mother for any period of time is a pretty devastating loss for a kid. You know, they are the, in lots of cases, the mother is the person that the child locks onto when they're looking for security. And so not to be able to have that connection, that confidant that mothers can often play in a child's life, that security system that they feel, is a pretty significant loss as well.
How does the incarceration of a parent impact a child's mental health?
Well, as I said, I mean, the loss of a parent is likened to that of divorce. And so
So do you see like high rates of depression among children?
Depression, sometimes there are troubles in school. There can be for kids, especially given what can happen in neighborhoods when you hear from other people or you sort of hear in the background the whispers about, you know, such and such is not around.
So social stigma impacts there.
Right. You know, I don't know whether there's been enough science around it but you know, I would liken it to you know, some kids ganging up on you and you know, putting it behind your back, and then you might react in a different way.
So it's likely that we might see higher levels of bullying and things like that too.
And the results from that.
Right. What about, so we started out talking a little bit about communities as well and how this impacts communities or how communities can or can't sometimes support a family who has a family member in a prison. But then is the opposite true as well? When we have neighborhoods where there is a significantly disproportionate number of members of the community imprisoned, how does that in turn impact the community itself?
Well, there is this sort of sense of from and as I mentioned, from the vacuum that might exist of people missing from the community. So first of all, from a visual sense, there just aren't the sort of the eyes on the street that everyone we may take for granted in lots of ways. Someone who's looking out the window to make sure that things are okay. And the more of those that exist in a community, the greater sense of safety and security that you have in your neighborhood. So that's one impact. There is this loss of collective income in the neighborhood. And so that means that in certain cases, poverty rates, which otherwise would have been, may have been stable in certain neighborhoods, may actually rise. Because of the lack of income, which then translates into the lack of quality housing availability, the lack of people being able to actually stay stable in a house, and the sort of the cumulative impacts of those things, and one person being 10 people, being 20 people, being 100 people missing from a community that then plays out block after block, neighborhood after neighborhood in certain parts of our cities and our towns.
And in your report, you showcase a few cities, Atlanta, Providence, and Indianapolis, to kind of point out how neighborhood by neighborhood you see impacts. Can you, why are those cities good examples to look at?
We looked at we could look at almost any number of cities. We highlighted those cities in particular because of the gaps in the rates of poverty that can exist in one part of the city versus another, and where the rates of incarceration or people missing from those communities because of incarceration may be higher. So those served as three pretty good examples. But it
So
could
that means you see a strong correlation in neighborhoods where there's fewer people incarcerated, poverty rates are lower in neighborhoods where there's more people incarcerated, you see a stronger correlation with higher poverty rates.
Can you repeat that again?
So do you see a correlation between poverty rates and the number of people incarcerated neighborhood by neighborhood in these cities?
You see a stronger correlation between poverty and people incarcerated in these cities. I mean, in the Atlanta example, we've been working in Atlanta for a while, and we've noticed sort of these neighborhoods that are south of Interstate 20, which are the higher poverty neighborhoods, also seem to have some of the are also some of the neighborhoods with the higher rates of people who have been involved in the criminal justice system in one form or another. And the way that plays out for people in those neighborhoods is one, it is either the people who are missing from the community because of incarceration, the people who are coming back into the neighborhood who may not be able to secure a job because of ticks against them in the job application process, although
Right.
Georgia is working to amend that and working to amend the ban the box legislation. But those are the types of things that sort of accumulate over time in a neighborhood and play out from one generation to the next.
Right, that was going to be my next question then, because of course, unless you have a life sentence, when you're incarcerated, you're going to come back, presumably into your own community, or more likely to come back to your own community. But then it's not that the impacts of your being missing disappear, they linger because it's harder to find jobs once you are a felon, even if you've served your time. And of course, that in turn impacts the family. So what are the recommendations that your organization, Annie E. Casey Foundation, make to remedy this? I mean, we have a federal prison system, but then we have a patchwork state prison system. Each state has its own sort of system of incarceration. What sort of recommendations do you make to remedy the fact that families and children are suffering alongside the people who are incarcerated?
Sure. Well, first, you mentioned federal and state systems. You know, it's important to point out that about 80% of the people who are incarcerated are in state systems.
Right.
And out of roughly $80 billion that is spent in the incarcerating folks in the United States every year, about $50 billion of that is spent at the state level. It's a pretty significant dollar amount on a state by state basis. And so some of the things that we recommend in the report, they fall into three, you know, roughly three large categories. One is really the supports for children and families. You know, things that can be done to one, reinforce and strengthen the connections that children have with their parents, which could include judges, the discretion the judges can use when making sen when sentencing someone, and the location where they sentence them, so that the child can actually have access or greater access.
Right, we didn't even talk about that because often parents who are incarcerated can be, you know, moved around or just in really far away prisons, making it harder for children to maintain any bonds with them. And then, of course, transportation costs set up, time away from job for the parent who is remaining. So that, yeah, and very rarely do we even hear that being discussed.
Right, and they could be, you know, they could be hours away, and in remote places and states where there may not be a robust transportation network. And again, since we're talking about families who may be, you know, low power or high poverty families, they may not have access to a car to be able to get to prison. And then once they get there, if the visitation site is not a family friendly place, you know, it can feel alien to the child. And so there are things that we can do that are not necessarily high cost solutions, that are there's high touch solutions that would enable that child to feel the connection between themselves and their parent. There are also supports that are needed for the families. You know, and they can range from the supports that families need as someone may be transitioning back into the community and back into the family, for the situation in the family has changed over time. You know, the person who may have been the head of household, or you know, the lead parent, who is now in prison, is getting ready to come back, and over that time, the situation may have changed in that household, so that the other parent is now taking the lead. And how you manage that transition back in. For the person who once felt that they were in the lead, who may no longer be in the lead, is one factor to take in. There are things around financial, legal, housing services that families need. And so that's one area of support that would be needed, is really for both the kids and the families in the emotional and financial and legal support services. Secondly, there are a set of things for the person who is returning from prison. As I mentioned, you know, people who are coming out of prison often are trying to get back into work. And in while 20 states, 20 plus states have passed ban the box policies, that means there are another 20 who have not. You know, there have been lots of cities and towns and businesses that have done it as well. But one of the recommendations that we offer is really for more places and more states to pass ban the box policies. And those ban the box, for those who may not know, is that on a job application, there is that little box that you check at the bottom of the application that indicates whether you have been arrested or have been convicted of a crime. And for the person who is returning from prison, one, to see that means that for them, they feel like their talent doesn't shine, but their incarceration is the shadow over that application. So eliminating that box allows for someone to really evaluate your application on the skills, the qualities, and the value that you may be able to bring to their organization first.
Right.
Then to be able to check on your record later to determine whether you'd be eligible to work there.
Scott, give out a website where people can get a hold of the report that we've been discussing.
Sure. The report, as you call it, is called a shared sentence, and you can find it at www.aecf.org/shared-sentence.
And we'll post a link to that from our website later today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great, thank you.
Scott Spencer is the Associate Director for Influence and Advocacy at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.